Hey, everybody. Welcome to the next episode of the Strand Tennis Center podcast, filled with tips, advice, tennis, not tennis, just life advice, too, whatever you need. Like it on YouTube. Share it on the podcast as well. Thank you.
All right, everybody. Welcome to the Strand Tennis Center podcast. We are so lucky to have another fantastic guest today, Marvin Dent. I don't even know where to begin, Marvin, because I did a little homework, obviously. I was trying to do it.
Yeah.
But we got a good something? We got enough... But, Marvin, I mean, gosh, where do you start? Do we start at City College? Do we start on the Ivory Coast where you were teaching? Do we start when you were selling wine? I mean, oh, my God, where do we begin all of this, Marvin? What? Could go this in different avenues, and I do want to discuss the white paper and the book you want to write, too. I want to discuss that, which sure. I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. But, boy, it's almost like I just want to ask you, tell me, like, some of the most impactful moments. What was the two things that come to mind in the course of your experience in your life that were saying, okay, one that was a crossroads, one that you felt like you had the most impact. I guess let's do that one first. Like, where was the crossroads in your life that you said, I could have gone left, I could have gone right, and I think I made the right decision, or sometimes we make the wrong one, but give me one of those, like a crossroads decision.
Well, I should tell you, first of all, the first ball that I ever hit, the first time I ever had a racket in my hand, I was headed to spring football practice.
I heard this story.
Oh, yeah, so you know
that. Had your football gear on.
Had my football gear.
Go ahead, tell it. Tell the story.
Yeah, well, I had the football gear on, and it was on a dare that you think you're so good because I had participated in all the other sports that I enjoyed. And I said, oh, really? I grabbed his racket and hit the ball perfectly. And I was so mesmerized, it changed my projection.
So it made you cockier. Just kidding.
No, actually, it did. Yeah, it did. It put another notch. It was later on that tennis opened my throat and forced the humility down my throat.
Okay. Yeah, it is a humbling sport. It is.
Yes. And I appreciated it because I thought, like, perhaps I was a good basketball player or football player overnight. When I realized what role the tennis brought and how impactful it was to the individual, I said, I don't want to coach basketball or tennis. I want to coach a sport that I know very little about.
Huh. This was in Carolina where you grew up?
This is in Carolina.
Durham? Durham area?
This is in college, in Durham. Okay. Yes.
So is that the first time you ever saw a tennis court or any, like, had you seen this before? Have you seen it played? Were you watching it on TV at all? Had you ever seen it?
The football coach in the town, I grew up around the Outer Banks.
Okay.
The football coach and the basketball coach, who I both adored, and they were hoping that I would stay in Elizabeth City and participate in both sports.
Okay.
And the small town mentality just did not want me to be there.
Okay.
And after going to Durham and seeing what they call the sloping hills and virgin green, all the water didn't seem so appealing. So that was my first, I ball boy for them, not knowing what's called ball boy.
Okay.
I was just hanging out. I hung out at their houses a great deal. They were pretty upset when I did leave the town, but they understood eventually because we stayed friends for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
And, when I had no idea. My next awareness of tennis was on that junket down to football practice.
Huh. And so you were about 18, you said, right?
18. But here's the crazy part. I made the team, the traveling team. I never really played the following year.
Huh.
Barely able to keep score.
Yeah, that's tough.
Well, I mean, that's
tough
had
to do in a year to make a team.
Yeah, I had no idea what I was doing, but I actually later on realized that was the best thing that could have happened to me, not having conscious awareness of what I was doing.
You won't get nervous. You're just like, I don't even know the score.
I was too stupid to be nervous.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. That's a great thing to do. Tennis is, you know, it's all your mind, it's all mentally, and if you can take that out of the equation, oh, my God, and just play the point to just play it, it's great.
Yes, that the realization of what you're saying came a little later when veterans were asking me to show me my forehand. because I didn't realize it was a weapon. I was just doing it. I don't know whether ping pong or what was the difference that made it so natural. I have no clue.
You start playing, you have a natural ability for it. Then how do other these people hit or read? Or did you feel that was going to get in the way then? Or did you try to study?
Well, what happened was I was living in New York at the time in the Bronx.
Okay.
And I could take a bus up to Crotona Park.
Okay.
And on the clay courts. And that was my deal every day. I worked in the recreation department.
And this is how long since you were 18 from North Carolina to the hell were you?
This was
Park?
Right away. Oh, I got a job at the recreation department, okay. New York City Recreation, and started playing and realizing how difficult it was.
Yeah.
But the more I realized how difficult it was, the more I enjoyed playing.
Okay.
And so.
Back to the courts. Sorry, clay courts, getting those clay courts ready.
Getting on the clay courts. And, I forgot about having to. My punishment for walking on the courts was that I had to take care of the courts. And just so happens that my position coach was also the tennis coach.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And he had an enormous impact on my life. He actually tried to send me to medical school.
Oh, okay.
And I said, Coach, I'm afraid of my own blood.
And this is back in Carolina.
This is back in Carolina. Okay. So
you're like, okay, I'm going to come back. So did you have family in the Northeast? Is that why you came back to the Northeast, or you just had an opportunity to get a job out there?
No, my mother lived in my mother.
Oh, okay.
I kept going back and forth from North Carolina to New York.
Okay.
My mother was concerned as she worked during the day of me getting into gang fights and that sort of thing.
Okay.
So I had to go back and live with my grandparents in the Carolinas. Which was healthier than my grandparents to say, well, you either work or you play a sport. And so that's how I played all the sports.
So you're working for the city, and is that when you got the job at City College? After you're working for the city, that was the job?
No, now City College was an interesting aspect. My first 7 years, I worked with the Department of Transportation of New York State.
Okay.
And I was an inspector. With the Bruckner Expressway project, the Verrazano Narrows project, Brooklyn-Queens Kosciuszko Bridge expansion project. I passed a test with some mathematical background, and again, serendipitously, I wound up there. But it was an accident, and I lost a close friend, and I lost my appetite for construction. So there is my next venture was as a wine salesperson for Gallo Wines. And I wound
all
up.
All over the place.
All over the place.
It's not that he worked as a wine salesman.
Yeah. Oh, really?
He did.
Yeah. So I wound up having dinner at the Gallo's house and in their yards and drinking wines that they wouldn't sell because it was only theirs. That was another experience until another traumatic experience happened. When fair trade was taken off of other spirits.
It was like in the 70s, right, or somewhere? Where was that?
Around the 70s. And Rockefeller instituted a rule that instituted methadone. You'd have to use the state-sponsored program or to put the pusher in the jail.
Okay.
And so in the wine area of Canandaigua in New York, they had these fortified wines. They called them wines with wild Irish rose. But all the stores were next to methadone centers.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. And they were able, they had the strength to keep all the deaths that were happening from the methadone and the wine. There were kids were dying on the rooftops. And I had a difficult time.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know what to do after that, and someone suggested that I apply for the job that was vacant at City College.
Huh. So
that was my first coaching experience, was City College. Well, you know, actually, it was so long ago, I can't remember whether it was Wardlaw Hartridge High School first or City College first, but actually both of them kind of wound up together.
Incredible journey. So obviously it's a coaching facility. You've coached here. Obviously you have great experience coaching. For first-time coaches, you got your first class, you're coaching a team. Do you do all of this research, or you just say, listen, I'm just going to take what I get from the students and give them the feedback that I know? How do you prepare for your first day? I'm trying to think about the first day I coach something. It's hard to remember. Do you have any memories of the first team or the first way you prepared or felt like, and you look back, sometimes I look back and go, wow, in the beginning when I coached, I talked way too much. So in other words, I said too much because I felt like I had to give all this information when really you only need to say a couple of things here and there. So did you have that experience where you've just got – tell me your experience first coaching. I'm rambling on here.
Thank goodness I had a coaching position first.
Okay.
So – and as years turned out, I recognized that teaching, coaching, training, and development are all different categories for tennis. Yeah. And because I was a coach first, I some of the players may have had more experience than I did. Our first year, we finished last in the conference. I went to the music department and asked, were there any tennis players? My thought was, if they had the discipline to master an instrument, they had the discipline already to be tennis players.
Yeah.
We finished second in the conference and was invited to Rochester to play in the Northeastern Conference and the championships against all the schools like Army and whatever.
So, how many players did you get out of that music class?
I had 7.
That's awesome. That's a great. That's a great thing from Charlie Munger, who just recently died, who was vice president of Berkshire Hathaway. Modalities. Go across different modalities, because what happens, we get siloed into one area and we don't look into, like, that's why great finance people study psychology. That's a fantastic way to be successful as a coach, like John Wooden, all of those things. But so you finished second. How long were you at City College for?
About 5 or 6 years.
5 or 6 years.
Yes. And it, as college positions are pay part-time but demand full-time.
That's true. It's any of the high school positions, any of those college positions, you have to work double and you get paid half as much.
Absolutely.
That's
absolutely
so true. Oh my. So there's so many different avenues I could tell. I had your letter, your New York Times letter to Arthur Ashe. Remember that letter you wrote, City College?
Very well.
Yeah, remember that?
I remember that very well.
So many things we can discuss, but oh my God, I could trail off forever.
Maybe I could make the transition to New Jersey.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and my friend Arthur Carrington was coaching a team, actually two teams, on the tennis courts, indoor courts on Route 22. I've forgotten the name of them.
Indoor courts on 22 Mountainside?
No, the one further down in Union.
The one further down in Union? It's not there anymore, is it?
Probably not there anymore.
Yeah, I don't think it's there anymore.
Yes, yes. Well, the team from Ashbrook, which is also not there anymore, behind Inman, they were asking his Arthur, since they didn't like traveling that far, did he have someone who could coach their team? They didn't have to travel. And he recommended me. So I went to Ashbrook, and it was a wonderful time. And when they decided to close, the ladies went to Inman in their fur coats and asked. Now, Inman at the time had 14 indoor courts.
Yeah.
And they only had one women's team, Central Jervis team. And the indoor season, the daytime was the lifeblood of indoor courts. So since they only had one team, and they said, yes, he could come, but he can't advertise. And they said, he won't have to advertise. It'll be word of mouth. So I brought four teams over. And over a course of about 5 years, it had to be probably the best opportunity and job I ever had. I never had to make a phone call. Mm. I never had to collect any money. I never did anything. I just went on the court. I never had to pick up balls. It was just a fantastic experience. And one day I got a call from Arthur Ashe. And I wouldn't even take, I thought they were kidding and wouldn't take it. Twice they had to come out to get me and say,
that's a joke. So go ahead. Well, yeah. How'd the call go?
Well, he asked me, would I be interested in relocating to West Africa.
Wow.
To help the continent develop Davis Cup teams, because Chatrier was nervous and he was on the Olympic committee, and he knew that tennis was going to become a medal sport. And he asked, would I be interested in relocating and helping the continent develop teams? And now, once I arrived, there was not even a zone to play in. There was not a zone for the regions. They were going to Europe to participate.
Okay.
So I had to request to, well, first, I didn't want to go to France and ask Chatrier, because of his relationship with Cameroon and that idea of any form of Francophone country, finding a good player and having them participate with France if they're good. So I went to England. There was a man there named Doug McCurdy. I don't know if you know that name.
No, don't.
No, he's really fantastic individual. And he was running, he worked at Roehampton, the ITF office in London. And I suggested that we have a zone to play in. I convinced the other countries it will be in your best interest to have a zone to play in. So I said, why don't you make it like soccer, which they only had two zones at the time, long before they got so good to have three zones now.
Yeah.
But it was a north and a south zone, so that meant we had to play against North Africa, where we're full of clay courts. At the time, we didn't have, we only had hard courts.
Okay.
So during my, I had to reach back in, for my experiences in construction and engineering to help build clay courts and put the stones down, the three-quarter stones. And we played our first match against Algeria in Algiers. Now, Algeria fought for their independence, and the country that I was representing, Cote d'Ivoire, they voted to remain a part of the French Commonwealth. It was so much acrimony that the Spanish referee had to almost call the gendarmes to break it up.
So this leads me to a series of questions. Number one, Inman is now Garden State. It's in Edison. Yeah. But coaching on a indoor court, being a coach, getting a call from Arthur Ashe is like getting a call from, I don't know, like Roger Federer calling you up, like after you're done with your... Did you even ask Arthur Ashe, how'd you get my number? Like, how did he... like?
Well, he... I think this was after we had open letter exchanges.
Okay. The New York Times.
New York Times.
That was in 77. Okay.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And we had a mutual friend. Bob Davis was actually his doubles partner. He was the person that was working with Bollettieri in the Ask Bollettieri ventures. And he suggested, because Arthur didn't really know, but Arthur... When he was asked about our letter that had a different view, Bud Collins wanted to know, well, who's Marvin then? He said I was his alter ego.
Oh, okay.
He very much perhaps respected the letter that in my difference of opinion or how I expressed it. And so we had great respect for each other, even if we had differing opinions.
So... everybody, you just go online. New York Times, Marvin Dent, Arthur Ashe letter. You could read it. It's from 1977. Was it hard to get it in the New York Times, or because you're working for the city and you were like, I have enough connections, I can get this letter written and seen?
Long before, Bill Cosby was ocular at some point later on to the African American community. So Arthur's letter to the parents, I felt he was right, but for the wrong reasons.
Okay.
And his letter was syndicated around the world. And he got 5,000 replies. And they printed mine and Dr. Orlando Patterson's from Harvard University.
Okay.
And the editor of the Times wrote me a letter and a check to say, you are my hero. Your letter will be printed as it was submitted without a change of I's or T's, and thank you very much for it.
Well, it is an incredible letter, Marvin. It is. It is. So everybody should read it. I suggest you do. So, like all these jumps, we're everywhere. We can go anywhere. But so I don't want to get bogged down, but you've come this far. You've taught so many kids. You've taught national champions. You work for the USTA. You've done this. What made you get to this point? Because I want to get to the book you want to write. pickleball's exploded, like we've said. It's become this huge sport. And your book is basically, you know, what tennis can learn from the pickleball explosion. What made you have the itch to want to write this?
Well, there were several factors, Steve. First of all, there's been, pickleball is not very popular in countries that are ruled by federations.
Okay.
Right? But it's gaining popularity in Australia, in England. You know what's happening here in America. The only exception to associations not so popular is Japan. It's an association, but in Japan, very often, the president of the ruling accrediting entity is also the president of the certifying entity. So, and actually, I knew that person very well. While I was in Africa, the ambassador to Africa's wife was number one in Japan, named Nana Soto. And she had all of these bandages on her, and she came to see me, and I said, Nana, how'd you get the bandages? She said, an American coach that I'll allow go nameless came to our country, and all of us are injured. And after working with a couple of months, she was able to get rid of all the bandages. And she went to Wimbledon and had a very successful Wimbledon championship and in doubles matches with against Martina and Pamela Shriver.
Oh.
Right? She came back and asked me, would I please consider coming into Japan? Everything would be taken care of. And I was pretty excited. While I was at Inman, I had spent 4 semesters studying Japanese, because all the Japanese players that came, all the Japanese families that moved to Westfield, they came and only spoke to me. So, and my Japanese got really, really good. I was even the May Day King at their celebration in Westfield. That was an odd thing, being wrapped around the pole in Westfield, and everybody wondering, where did this guy come from? And he's the only person of color in this place here. How does this work out?
Wow.
So, yeah, so it was an interesting experience. But she wound up being both the president of the accrediting association as well as the certified. And she also did the reporting for Japan when they had the U.S. Open here.
Okay.
So it was a unique experience. But Acid already, and ProServe, who represented me, had already assigned me to Trinidad to go there and to instruct 200 school teachers, principals, and athletic directors how to implement tennis in the school system so that their participants would have a chance to matriculate in the states and colleges.
So I don't want to interrupt, but I'm trying to figure out the federation issue.
Oh.
Why don't they want to support pickleball, in other words? Why do federations against that? Because they want to see, go ahead.
Yeah, they're not against it at all.
Okay, they're not.
Not at all. It just so happens that my contention is that the method in which we deliver tennis failed the adult recreation population. They want to have fun. They want to play doubles. They want to get out. We made the learning curve so steep and so difficult that they would lose interest in it. So it's my complaint that our delivery system needs to have a reevaluation.
Okay.
And when I look at the American colleges, I'm reading a book by a gentleman who mentioned how the first time he went to an NCAA tournament, he got so excited, and he got one of the brochures and he brought it home, and he realized that there were 3 times more foreign players on each team than American players.
It's true.
And they were all at a higher seeds. And
yeah.
I mean, I don't have to tell you what that story is about.
Yeah.
So it was called the American way of coaching. And because anybody can hang out a shingle after you hit a ball or two. Yeah.
So do you think the delivery system of, you know, the Barcelona way or those kind of ways of teaching, these federations do support their local communities like crazy. They're told, you know, I guess the USTA could be a little bit more grassroots. I remember, you know, they're not really, you know, they built an incredible facility in Orlando, but a lot of these federations across the world are giving rackets and putting rackets into hands to as many kids as they can. It's a little different, I guess, on the USTA side.
Well, let me give you a little background there. The federations are actually ministerial posts, meaning they're part of the government. They have strict control over who's certified. It doesn't matter how many Grand Slams you win. If you walk on a court to teach a lesson, that court would be levied a six-digit fine, and so would the player, so would the coach.
Huh.
So they have strict control over who's able to deliver it. You can't go a week to a class and be certified. You have to spend time in psychology, science. You have to know gender differences. You understand learning patterns, brain types. You have to go the full bevy of.
I agree. That's my big contention with the USTA as well, that it's too inclusive. It's not exclusive enough. It's got to be a lot harder to be a teacher.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that is exactly. We're on the same page because that's part of the reason that I'm involved in developing the book, the outline for the book, is to really investigate. I don't just want to be polemic and just have my views. I really want to ask the people involved and see, especially entrepreneurs like yourself, who've been on both sides of the table.
Yeah.
And what do you see, perhaps, that we can learn?
Well, I would assume, pickleball has exploded because it's much more inclusive, like we said, and it's the barrier to entry is a lot lower. You can learn the game a lot easier and quicker and have a lot more fun. Tennis is a very difficult sport to learn. It takes a longer time, and maybe the pressurized balls, like they do in Barcelona, work with those kids, and they're very successful with it. Maybe it helps. I don't know, Marvin, with the pressureless balls, whether adults enjoy that. Like, they can be able to hit. That's a big question to me. Do we just have them all use pressureless balls? It's a lot easier to play, a lot easier to pick it up quickly because you're not dealing with a regular pressured ball.
I don't know. Here's what my research has indicated. I heard a lot about muscle memory. As a matter of fact, I got into a large argument once with someone I admired greatly, Vic Braden, about this whole idea of muscle memory. And he wrote extensively about how it maybe didn't even exist because the ball leaves the racket long before the information arrives at the central nervous system. And the professor, that information that he used, indicated that along the central nervous system, cognitive information only travels about 4 to 6 meters per second. So that means that the 0.4 of a second that a ball is on the strings is long gone before the information even runs to the brain. So when my conversation with Vic, I said, well, he only gave you half the idea. We have several brains, and the fine motor skill operates at 100 meters per second. How do we know, or a soccer player know, or a baseball player know, which direction to run at what speed to rendezvous with a arriving ball? We can't even know that because it's done on a totally different level. The cognitive brain and the fine-tuned motor brain, they don't speak the same language. There's no connection to it.
Sure.
And so what it says is that we have a different system. We should not be teaching muscles. Muscles are pretty dumb.
Yeah.
The master system is a nervous system. That would mean that we put rackets and balls into hands of young people and adults far too early. There are methods to address the nervous system that would indicate and myelinate. Do you remember the talent code?
Myelinating
the connection between the synapses and neurons.
Sure.
Before. And I don't want to go back to another story, but about my forehand, that was so great. Everybody kept telling me that if I took lessons on my backhand, I would really be awesome. So I went back, asked for the lessons, and the guy asked me let me see your forehand. I said, I don't know how I hit my forehand. I'm not playing, I don't know how I would hit it. Mm-hmm. And he interrupted and brought me into awareness.
Yeah.
And then when I was asked to show the forehand again, I didn't know what it was. I have never found my original forehand that I hit on that tennis court.
And they put you into your brain. Okay. Yeah. I totally understand.
Yeah. So it made me not want to talk. I had to be extremely careful about how I dealt with players. I didn't want to be in their head at all after what happened to me. Turns out Oscar Wegner said the same thing happened to him.
Yeah. Like The Inner Game of Tennis, which is a great book. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Awesome. So would you then create a program where the kids are older? You don't start them so young?
Well, tennis is not really a very good first sport.
Yeah.
And it's certainly not a very good only sport, right? Developing athleticism and understanding that we commonly assume that we have five senses, and we don't. We have nine senses. In number eight and number nine, equiperception and proprioception, the tennis player desperately needs. Equiperception is vestibular sense, equal balance, knowing where you are in space. Well, if anything needs you to know where you are in space, tennis demands that. And proprioception is the relationship between the arms and the legs and the core of the body. Do we ever need control of our arms? Every joint, the wrist, the elbow, the shoulders, our knees and hips, they all have to have an intelligence. You can't do that if you can put the racket in the hand very well. The hula hoops helps us undulate, right? The ribbons, gymnastic ribbons, begin to help us to myelinate the movement for every ball. But what do? We stick a racket in the hand and try to get them to step and do awkward things that have no relationship to the game and make that a learning process. This is so unfair.
Yeah, I see you out there with the whip, too, sometimes. Same kind of thing, yeah.
Yes, the same. Yeah. Again, knowing where the strike zone is relative to your body. So.
Sometimes I have no sense, Marvin. That's what they tell me. Not nine. None. But, oh, my God, Marvin. So what tennis can learn from pickleball is the fact that pickleball is just – I don't see many lessons taught in pickleball. You know
exactly.
What I mean? I don't see many teaching people. People just go out there, you teach them the rules, and they hit.
Right.
So they're not really in their brain at all.
Exactly.
If that's what we're talking about, why it's so much more popular, because you're not bogging down people with all of this stuff to make them so much in their head, so to speak, because I'm a layman. I don't know about the brain as much as Marvin. So I guess that's why it could be a lot more popular quicker, and we need to teach people to not think out there and just kind of maybe, like you said, between ribbons, whips, and things like that, to just kind of throw them out there without putting them all in their head too much.
Absolutely. And I have a contention about the language that we use. I contend we don't hit the ball.
Okay.
I contend it's a receiving and sending sport. And the term grip, I think we got that from baseball and golf, but they have round grips.
Yes.
A tennis racket is octagonal.
Yeah.
Right? And that means it's an art first. That means if it's an art first, there's a theory behind it before it's a game. And so a technical foundation needs to be established in order to enjoy the experience of it. We wouldn't play the piano or violin without a technical foundation.
So it's almost redefining the whole thing, redefining the whole sport so we can get to a better foundation to begin the learning process easier.
An excellent way to say it,
okay. It's fascinating, Marvin. I can't wait till the book is done. I'd love to read it. And it's true. And, you know, tennis took off in the 70s. It was a similar boom. That pickleball has, but I understand what you're saying, that pickleball has got a lot more legs because we are not teaching people. We're not teaching them pickleball. There's very few lessons. It's, again, like I'm repeating myself, but it's understand the game. This is how you play. You go out there and hit. Go ahead.
The three E's. Pickleball satisfies the three E's. And tennis could enjoy it if we approach it properly. And everybody's going to yearn this.
I'm going to write it down.
Education, entertainment, and exercise. For young people, you're going to have a short span of attention, so your educational process will be shorter. But you can lengthen the entertainment and the exercise. And if there's fun involved, fun plus information yields long-term learning. And we ignore it. Pickleball is right on it. Won't miss it.
The three E's. That's great, Marvin.
Yeah.
So we always discuss this, me and Santi, a macro discussion. Is it because, now maybe tennis would have been even more popular in their 70s if we taught that way. Is it because our society is just getting older and people don't want to work as hard? And my father was, you know, in the Korean War. Everybody went through depressions and things like that. Do we have it too good in society? And this is the reason why people don't want something that's a little harder to learn and more difficult. I don't know.
Well, my aspiration is to lower the learning curve.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah. And if I'm able to lower the learning curve, there is a reason they contend that tennis players live longer than anyone else.
Yeah.
Right?
I saw the Blue Zones, yes.
Yeah, it's the Blue Zone. The Blue Zone, is that amazing?
Yeah.
Right? So if we properly teach the game, and one of my really big concerns is how many females we injure in the process.
Okay.
My sole purpose, and you saw me working with young girls, my sole purpose was to manage them through their puberty without injury.
Yeah.
Because if you teach it incorrectly, if we allow them to use the racket incorrectly, and the fact that they're growing constantly and their body's changing constantly, plus there's a chemical involvement. Young people, young girls especially, experience more depression than anyone else in society because of the introduction of estrogen in our system. And so if we don't have compassion in how we deal with them, instead of taking them out of the oven to taste them long before they're prepared for it, we induced competition far too early to make to give a traumatic game like tennis to someone and ask them to perform and then judge them on results rather than process. Yes?
It's gotten a lot worse. It was a lot worse when Capriati and all those people were playing the pros when they were 15 and there was no limitations. At least there's some limitations on how many tournaments they can play and all that, and I agree. I mean, you were a perfect example. Anya Breland from Wake Forest, you coached her whole career, and she's a national championship. Not many injuries. She wasn't out for very long. You did an incredible job with her, so yeah.
Yeah, she was injured in college because in college they have...
They got a hold of her.
well, what happens in college, they can't afford a trainer themselves, so they use a football trainer.
Yeah.
Well, what does he know about?
That's so true.
Whole different movement, whole different kinetic chain. Steve, I have had girls who were injured and lost their careers from that experience. I've had girls who didn't want to play anymore after that experience. So, I mean, that's a whole other animal. College, the coaches can't get paid, so they're recruiters. They're not coaches. So that's...
Marvin, we can talk all day.
I know.
We can talk all day. So, Marvin, what do you think the title of the white paper of the book's going to be?
Right now, I'm asking what can tennis learn from pickleball. I'm open to something more catchy.
Okay.
But right now, I'll leave it to that and let the outline dictate and the book dictate where it goes.
Well, Marvin, I can't wait to read it after this discussion. I think we should have a part two, Marvin, because there's a lot more to go. We just have to cut it off because we got so many things to do at this club. We're an active club, you know, Marvin. We
got to
teach lessons.
Well, I'd be happy
but
to.
But, Marvin, it's so great to have you here. I learned a ton. The three E's, everybody. Thank you for being
Thank you
awesome.
For the opportunity.
Thank you, guys. See you.
Hey, everybody. Hope you like the podcast. Please share it with your friends, anybody that you know, anybody that's into tennis, anybody that's into bettering themselves. Share it.